Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
Recently, I've read several articles that have linked the presence of slaughterhouses to crime. And in my reading, I came across a quote from animal behaviorist Temple Grandin. It is difficult to care about animals, but be involved in killing them. I agree with that wholeheartedly, but unlike others, when I read that, I didn't think of slaughterhouses. I didn't think of hunting. I thought of something completely different, and that took my thoughts back to a book I wrote almost 10 years ago. The name of the book is Death of a Shabby Tiger. On to the prologue. Practically everyone who lives in northern New England believes that anyone who lives in Los Angeles, Manhattan, and the entire state of New Jersey expects to be shot right between the eyes at point-blank range by a total stranger on any given day. However, Paul Renfrew, who lived and worked in East Haven, New Jersey, expected no such thing when he entered his office that bright January morning. Nor did the thought cross his mind later as he sat at his shabby desk in that shabby room and sorted through a pile of bills. "Who do we stiff this month?" he asked the empty room, which by no means was silent because nowhere on the 5 acres that surrounded Renfrew's home and business could you escape the sound of barking dogs. 150 dogs, give or take, all amassed for one purpose and one purpose only, to produce purebred pups for the insatiable East Coast metropolitan markets lusting for whatever real or imaginary dimension owning a purebred dog could add to their owners' lives. Paul Renfrew owned and operated what dog lovers referred to as a puppy mill on their most charitable days, and a hellhole the rest and majority of the time. Row upon row of postage-stamp-sized runs enclosed in a restraining patchwork of chain-link fencing, chicken wire, and hardware cloth provided the animals only access to fresh air and exercise. The lucky dogs lived here. The rest of the animals lived in an assortment of fiberglass carriers haphazardly strewn about one large room. Any dog who wound up here could find his or her services at the East Haven Kennel terminated without warning and sometimes with extreme prejudice. The CIA's polite macho euphemism for a one-way trip to that big bowl of kibble in the sky. In addition to Paul Renfrew, the canine inhabitants of the kennel were tended by a workforce which 99% of the local business community considered unemployable. When other business owners discussed East Haven Kennel's employees, they shook their head in disbelief. "Why would anyone hire such a ragtag bunch?" they asked each other whenever Renfrew's name came up. "The guy's got to be sick to be in that business to begin with," came the usual answer. "Anyone who would work for him would have to be sicker." Even though Renfrew could always hear the dogs, a thick stand of evergreen trees and shrubbery separated the rundown building that doubled as his home and office from the kennel. A deaf person who turned in at the driveway next to the mailbox marked simply as 37A would have no idea that the kennel existed. However, if that person missed the narrow, slightly overgrown roadway and turned at the next one marked by a medium-sized sign, East Haven Kennel in blue letters on a white background with a leaping Cocker Spaniel, also in blue, he or she would almost certainly be greeted by protesters whose placards would make it clear exactly what kind of hellhole Paul Renfrew operated, with or without any noise. Renfrew's visitor that morning almost did miss the narrow driveway just before the mailbox. Had he not realized his error, he would have seen the protesters and they him, the last thing he wanted on that particular day. However, he did realize his mistake, and he arrived on Renfrew's doorstep at exactly 9 o'clock as planned. "Any problem finding the place?" asked Renfrew as he motioned the visitor into his house. The other man shook his head. "I have relatives in the area and spent some time here as a kid. Things look pretty much the same." "You want to see the kennel?" Renfrew made the overture even though he had neither the time nor the inclination to perform such a tour. The visitor shook his head again. Like I said on the phone, I just want some background information. Can you tell me about your breeding program? Something about the way the stranger posed the question distressed Paul Renfrew, but he regarded sneaky reporters and devious animal rights activists an occupational hazard. Rather than ask his visitor why he wanted the information, he mechanically recited the facts about the inhabitants of East Haven Kennel in hopes of fulfilling his obligation as quickly as possible so he could get on with his work. "What about your staff?" then asked the stranger. "Much turnover?" Renfrew laughed ruefully. "Most of my staff could only turn over to some institution, so they're glad to work here. Consistency's a real problem, but turnover's practically non-existent." "Seems like a hell of a lot of work. Does it pay?" The puppy mill owner leaned across the desk toward his visitor. "I could sell every healthy pup my bitches pop out and probably 90% of the unhealthy ones," he informed the man tersely. "And don't let any dewy-eyed idealist tell you otherwise." "You don't think the breeders will run you out of business?" The visitor shifted his weight slightly in his chair as he posed the question. "Not in a million years," scoffed Renfrew. "If people want a purebred dog, most of them want it now, and with no strings attached. The demand far exceeds any supply individual breeders can or want to meet." "But what about public sentiment? Wouldn't the animal rights groups eventually turn everyone against you?" Paul Renfrew sighed heavily and looked out the window. "You walk down to the kennel today, you'll see a bunch of protesters, twice as many as yesterday, but a third as many as the day before. 1 week, one of them tried to torch the place. Next week, who knows? Eventually, they might shut me down, but that won't stop it. The dog business is a lot like the drug business." Renfrew turned back to his visitor and smiled slightly. "If the demand weren't there, there wouldn't be any suppliers. Only difference is that dogs definitely aren't detrimental to human health. I assume you agree?" He looked at the stranger expectantly. "In general, but not in your particular case." And having said that, the man pulled out a gun and shot the startled puppy mill owner right between the eyes. The prologue isn't done yet. I'll give you the second part of it in the next podcast. But for now, I'd like you to think about the setup here. What do you think is going on? What's going to be the mystery? How does it all fit together with what we know about the human-animal bond?
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.